The Approaching the Natural Podcast with Sid Garza Hillman. Sid is the author of Approaching the Natural, a health manifesto, a certified nutritionist, health coach, and programs director at the Stanford Inns Wellness Center on the Mendocino coast of California.
Hello, small steppers. Sid Garza Hillman here. Welcome to my show, my weekly podcast dedicated to helping people gain more health and happiness and live more naturally, not in like a new agey man, live more naturally kind of way, but kind of. If you're just joining me, that's a really rough start. I get it. Every week it's that way, though. If you go back and listen to old episodes, you'll see that's par for the course. I'm actually not against anything new agey either. In fact, small steppers are the newer age of health and happiness because we take on stuff in a way that doesn't add stress to our lives, or at least minimally stressful. We understand the struggle associated with true long-term change, and we make changes based on that knowledge. We know things and we act on that knowledge, and that's the success of this process. If you are just joining me, please go back and listen to old episodes because you'll get a sense of what I do here every week and why. For many people, it's a reminder. For some, it's just, you know, new knowledge and when it comes and all that kind of thing. Trying to make things fun. I know that's crazy. I know that's crazy that life should have fun in it, or at least being healthier and happier should be maybe even a little fun. I know that's just insane. But that is partly my goal. Okay? And the reason I want you to go back and listen to old ones is because once in a while, I throw in an interview with somebody who I think is, frankly, an ass kicker. And this week is no exception, but more on that in a second, because we are going to get right to this interview. I'm really excited about this one. And man, this was just like, just woo. Couple quick announcements before I go to this interview, and I will pop back at the very end. However, this episode is sponsored by Health Made Simple. It is not really a sponsorship. How's that for the big sell? It's a meal plan system. Less of a meal plan, more of a system of transitioning to healthier eating over time and sticking with it. Sound familiar? NoMeatAthlete.com/meal-plan-system. Links in the show notes. All right? iTunes reviews, still digging them, still needing them. Loving it. Thank you very much. SidGarzaHillman.com. You can donate to this podcast, which is also a huge help. Makes things, you know, easier. It's always going to be free, but it takes a little bit of the stress off for me. Okay? You can also buy t-shirts, mugs, bracelets, and custom signed copies of my book on that website as well. All things, you know, me are Sid Garza Hillman. So social media, just Sid Garza Hillman. Okay? Did I make things simple? Good. July 29th, 30th, and 31st is I will be at the World Vegan Summit. I think my actual speaking day is the 31st or maybe the 30th. You'd think I'd know. Go to worldvegansummit.com. That is coming up soon. Then I'm off to Edinburgh at the Veg Fest. I met a Scottish woman at the inn, heard the accent, and just like a fly to something that flies are attracted to, just walked right up. You're from Scotland? It was like drooling. said, I'm going to go there. She seemed, what's the word? Unimpressed. I will be at the World Veg Fest October 8th and 9th and the Atlanta Veg Fest November 12th. Just got in contact with them today. They emailed about my flight stuff. So that's happening. Very cool. The other news, and this is for real, if you watch my YouTube channel, then you know this, but I'm officially signed up for the North Face 50K in Marin somewhere. I'll find out where that is. But anyway, that's December 3rd. So, you know, come run it with me. It'll be really fun for Bay Area people. One of the people from the Stanford Inns running retreat might be coming up to run that with me, huh? That's cool, right? I do work at the Stanford Inn, stanfordinn.com, and I run their wellness center. And there's some very cool retreats, including a running one coming up with Matt Frazier in October. Okay, I'll come back at the end. Listen, here's who I'm interviewing today. For those of you who have been longtime listeners, you will recognize the name Matt Fitzgerald. He wrote a book called Diet Cults, and that's what I can't remember how I heard of that. But anyway, I brought him on before. He is the only, as you'll hear, the only guest to have been on twice on this podcast, which is a very, very special thing. I think he had some sort of confetti balloon melange that came out of his ceiling as a result of this exciting stuff. However, my buddy Bree, see, in that interview, I was talking about diet cults way back when, And I mentioned, you know, hey, so what are you up to? What's coming next down the pike? And he said, oh, I'm working on a book about, you know, the brain and exercise and endurance. And I was, you know, he was kind of working on it. So I didn't get too many details, but it sounded really interesting. And I just kind of lost touch until my buddy Bree, one of my training partners, said, you know, Matt's got this book out, and she handed it to me. And I was like, holy crap, he did it. And it's called How Bad Do You Want It? So I started reading it, and it's a good one. Totally up my alley. Now, this is about endurance, about mind over muscle. On the surface, it looks like it's about endurance athletes. It was not a super huge jump for me to move this completely to just everyday folks like me who are just trying to live healthier and happier. Now, you might go, but you sign up for a 50K. I am not a great runner, okay? I'm telling you, I'm just a average, very middle of the pack, slightly to the back of the pack kind of person. I've gotten into ultra running very recently in my life in response to increases in my diet and overall stress level. I'm just able to run faster, so I'm kind of bringing that out. But anyway, so Matt and this discussion and conversation I have with him is really about the nitty-gritty of struggle, what it takes to set goals, what it takes to endure and to last through a process. This is very exciting stuff. I loved this conversation. So I really hope you enjoy it. If you don't know who Matt Fitzgerald is, just look him up. He's written a bunch of books. He's a best-selling author. He's written for Bicycling, Maxim, Men's Fitness, Men's Health, Men's Journal, Outside, Women's Health. I mean, he's all over the freaking place. His books, How Do You Want It, 80-20 Running, Diet Cults, Racing Weight, The Runner's Edge, and more. He's everywhere. He's awesome. He's a really great writer, actually. His book is gripping in a weird way. And it's good stuff. So I'm not going to linger too much longer. I want you guys to listen to this episode. It's very cool, very cool. Matt's a great guy, and I was really happy to have him back. I want you to enjoy this interview and hope you do. If you do, and other things that I offer here, throw me a review, will you, for the love of all that's holy? Is that too much to? Oh, okay. Ladies and gentlemen, Matt Fitzgerald, enjoy. See, I'm like an amateur here. I've done 147 episodes, and I don't even know how to hit the freaking record button. Anyway, so there's going to be some struggle in this interview, so I just want to make sure that you've got your mental faculties in place.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah, because this is one of those things. So quick back story for my listeners. Matt, by the way, this is something you've probably aimed for your whole life, but you're the only guest to have appeared twice on my podcast.
I can die now.
You can. No more books necessary. So you're the second. Unfortunately, the one that you were on before is so long ago that it's not in the recent 50. So if somebody wants to go listen to that episode, they can go on my website and listen to that. In that episode, we went really into the background of you personally, and people should listen to that. And then we were talking about your book at the time, about the diet cults and things like that. So that was kind of that thing. At the end of that interview, you did mention that you were working on a new book, and this is that book, I believe, yes?
Probably.
Yeah, I even said, was like, what about neuroplasticity? Because I've been reading about that. You're like, well, it's not really that. It's going to be more about the mental game and also, you know, documenting certain athletes' experiences and things like that. So I'm glad you're here. The book's been out a little while, but not too long, right?
Yeah, I think the official pub date was November 1st last year.
Okay, and it's out there, and it was actually like somebody, a friend of mine, said, you know, Matt's got that book out. And I was like, oh, crap, I completely missed it. So I quickly got my hands on it, and here we are. So I thank you for coming back and talking to me for a little bit.
Great to be back.
So this this book, you know, the diet cult book was of definitely interest, because in my podcast I'm trying to move people definitely away from the diet way of thinking at all and talk about the bigger issues of living well in the modern world, things like that. The natural progression through that is into more of the mental game as it relates to living healthier and happier, how we develop rather than get swept up into a quick fix model of dieting where you're following what to do on day three kind of thing, developing, you know, a clarity of how you want to live in the world and then taking steps to match that as best you can. This book, ironically, because I'm a nutritionist and health coach, this book actually excited me even more as it relates to my own goals with my podcast and my practice, because it's so much about the mental
experience. I'll start off by asking you just this kind of quick question. Have you, I mean, you're a running coach. This is what you do, and you're an author and all these kinds of things. I see this book as it's got way bigger ramifications than just athleticism. Do you see that yourself?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, there's an epigraph at the front of the book. It comes from a novel called The Power of One by Bryce Courtenoy, or Courtenay, something like that. And it is the quote is, the mind is the athlete. And so that kind of says it right there, that I don't think there's any real distinction to be drawn between, you know, you on the race course and you as a human being in any other dimension of life. You know, you're the same person. So, you know, lessons that you learn in life, you can bring them to the race course and vice versa.
A lot of the, you know, I ran a couple ultras last year and one this earlier this year. And so I'm not, you know, big into that world really, but the experiences, and a lot of people said, why would you put yourself through that? And I'm really fascinated with the, you know, of course there's professional athletes, but for those of us who are just running and challenging ourselves to go a little further, the question is always like, why would you do that to yourself? I'm interested in your perspective and I know this, we'll get into the nitty gritty of the book for sure, but your perspective on like intentional struggle, putting yourself in a situation that you know is going to be difficult physically and then therefore mentally, or I don't know how you see that vice versa, because you talk about a lot about the book about it's the perception of struggle. I found it really fascinating that one of the things you mentioned was that dehydration doesn't actually slow somebody down. It's the perception of dehydration. I mean, that blows my, I love that. I sort of intuitively figured that to be true, but I love the physiology around that. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, there's so many examples like that where, I mean, you know, we are conscious beings for a reason. You know, not to get too philosophical or neurophysiological, but, you know, consciousness is a plane of causality. You know, there are those who look at us as sort of automatons, and everything that's really going on is just, you know, chemistry and electricity in your brain. But, you know, I really don't think that's the case, that, you know, because you are aware, you know, things happen there at the level of awareness. And, you know, that example you just gave is one where, you know, you have two things that are usually tightly coupled together, dehydration and thirst. You know, usually when you're dehydrated, you're thirsty. But in a cleverly designed experiment, you can actually get people to the point where they are dehydrated, but they're not thirsty. And when they do that, dehydration no longer has any negative effect on performance. So that's a, you know, a cool example of where, you know, the real action is occurring at the level of, you know, conscious sensation and perception.
And in terms of, I mean, which is obviously fascinating. I mean, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, but isn't there a real physical limitation? I mean, at some point, true dehydration will impair your physiological ability. But I think what you said in the book is that we actually never get to that point. And I wonder what your thoughts are or that, what you learned in the writing of this book about that. Does the brain, or at least our consciousness, have a mechanism that shuts us down long before the true physical ramifications of dehydration would?
Yeah. You know, again, we're dealing with some pretty subtle concepts here, but, you know, the distinction to be drawn in this regard is between a constraint and a limit. A constraint is sort of like the field of possibilities you operate within. A limit is what actually limits you. So you can be constrained by certain things, but you never actually have the opportunity to explore all those possibilities because you're limited by, you know, sort of narrower factors. And that's how it works with body and mind. You know, you can't jump off a building and fly just by believing you can. So, you know, physical limitations exist. There's certain things that you physically can't do. You know, nobody's run a 2-hour marathon because, you know, possibly, you know, physically they're not able to. But as you suggested, we actually encounter psychological limitations before we ever reach our ultimate physical limitations. And, you know, there's sort of an evolutionary just-so story you can tell to explain that. And it's probably accurate, which is that, you know, if we weren't constrained by psychology, by sort of, you know, the limit to our tolerance for effort, for perception of effort, then we could exercise ourselves to death, you know, very easily. Because if you think about, you know, if we didn't feel anything when we went out and ran a marathon, you know, what would happen? You know, the thing that actually hitting the wall instead of just feeling miserable and slowing down, hitting the wall could be, you know, literally cooking yourself.
right.
Yeah, you know, like, so these are the mechanisms that would kick in to make us stop if we weren't actually feeling anything when we exercise.
I guess that I'm going to throw this, it could be completely unrelated, so just bear with me, but something like hyponatremia, which would be the antithesis of dehydration, and yet people, there's a very physical limitation long before. That's sort of a limitation that happens without a perception.
Yeah. So, you know, to be clear, fatigue, sort of garden variety exhaustion, is not the only thing that could prevent you from reaching the finish line in a race. You know, you could have a cardiac event, or you could suffer, exertional heat illness, but that's not fatigue. So we sort of need to, you know, parse things out. So when we're talking about, standard limits to human endurance performance, which are, mediated through fatigue, those are the ones where we're talking about perception of effort being the true limiter. But, you know, in exertional heat illness, when you see someone, collapse in a marathon in warm weather, that's because you've actually damaged the governor, your brain. So if your brain is there to prevent your body from overheating, but what if your brain overheats?
Got it. Very interesting. Okay, so that's where that lies. And I wanted to, if you could just define for my listeners really what you're talking about here, and when you mention governor, like really what this is about. Because again, what I really want to take us to in this conversation is perhaps your ideas of how this relates to the struggle of anything related to improving your life. And I've said this like 1,000 times on my podcast, that to expect any kind of change, and then in your book it would be improvement in running, or at least success in a race or in training, to expect that kind of change that's struggle-free is completely unrealistic. And I recommend the other way, which is to accept that there's struggle, to understand that, get ready for it, and try to be able to handle what's coming better as a way to actually make long-term change.
Yeah. It's really important to get to the point. And we're not talking about masochism here. People, non-athletes or sedentary people, when they look at people who push themselves in events like this, they may think, oh, you like pain, or, there's something wrong with you. But that's really not true. It's that you get something out of it. That being said, if you can get to the point where you recognize that experiencing and pushing through struggle is inseparable from the benefits you're looking to take away from it, then you really get to the point where, without being masochistic, you embrace your suffering, you embrace the struggle, and that opens up all kinds of possibilities for transformation and improvement, where you're not hoping that it's not hard anymore.
Yeah, you don't expend wasted energy to try to avoid the struggle. You just go, okay, well, that's sort of a fact of life. Let me figure out how to deal with that better.
Exactly.
I think that there not the swing the other way, of course, who, like the adrenaline junkie, is how would you describe that as in the model of your book? Like, is that somebody who sort of goes on the other side of that to intentionally put them in pain? Or did you do any research in that kind of personality for this book?
Not really, because we're talking about endorphin junkies, and adrenaline junkies. There are similarities and differences. I think both, in a sense, are chasing sensation, but they're rather different. Chases. Whereas I just did a workout this morning where I was pushing myself. I was suffering and I was enjoying it. I enjoyed the experience of, working hard, but feeling that I'm the master of working. I'm the master of my effort. There is a thrill in that, and it's chemical, but I am not a daredevil. Don't put me on a high wire, or, make me ski a black diamond or something. So that's your, adrenaline junkie, still chasing sensation, but they tend to be just a different type personality wise.
Yeah, almost in a more balanced way. But this goes back to my comment earlier about, the questions I got of like why, like you just said, somebody who's stagnant goes you know, why would you, you must love that. Why would you put yourself in that kind of pain? And I've likened it to childbirth, you know, like why would it, it's painful. And so there must be something why we would want to do that. You know, there must be some payoff to engage in something intentional that we know is going to be a struggle. We know is going to be difficult, but we're very clear about the outcome. And yet what you just said spoke also to the feeling during the struggle. And that's an interesting psychology because, I mean, do you really think that it's the chemical thing, or is there another kind of something at play in our design as a human of consciousness to – do you know – I'm assuming you know who Sage Kanade is?
Yes.
Okay, he made a comment once. I think I've referenced a few times because it's fascinating. He says when he's running, he's able to separate – he used the words, I think, separate himself from the pain. And yeah. I just am so fascinated with that and how that obviously – to come back again, how that relates to us doing a diet or making – not a diet but changing something about the way we eat that there's – it's much more subtle than, you know, mile 75 of a 100-miler, but it's still there. It's a struggle. It's a – you know, you're forced to be aware in the moment. You can't zone out when you're feeling that kind of physical pain or even – or even emotional pain, like in a, you know, like missing the food that you love, you're present and in that moment, and how you negotiate that better as a person in the world. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, here's the simplest way I know to frame it. So, take someone who can't relate to, you know, running marathons and such, and maybe there's someone who just wants to, you know, lose weight, you know, through, you know, improved diet. Why do they want to do that? You know, so that they'll look better and feel better. Why do they want to look better and feel better? Because they want to be happy, right? That's really ultimately what we're all chasing is happiness. Now, you know, I firmly believe, just based on my experience as a human, that you cannot be a happy person unless you are a strong person and know you are a strong person. I think strength and awareness of strength, in internal strength, is just a huge component of happiness because you just feel self-determining. So, you know, so much of our chase for happiness is really unskillful, where we're just looking for outcomes and not thinking about the processes that are really kind of at the heart of it. And if you go through struggles and experiences that teach you that you are a strong person, that's just something you carry with you, you know, to any goal or any adversity, any challenge, any experience you take on in life. If you're strong and you know it, you've really got it made in the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think, you know, where I come from is that things like diets or even really training plans are things that are external to us. And if we put our eggs in the basket of, if I just follow that thing, it's going to be okay, we're missing out on the opportunity of bringing a mental aspect to how we approach those things. And what I read in your book was speaking directly to that regardless of what training philosophy you follow or even what diet you follow, it always comes down to your own personal, the way that you approach these things and your own personal growth or not as it relates to those plans.
Yes, exactly. I couldn't have said it better myself.
And in your coaching with runners, I mean, what part does this play in the way that you communicate to your runners? Do you talk about, okay, there's going to be struggle here, or like, how does that, I mean, it must be a great way to work with a coach rather than, you know, okay, well, here's what you do. You're going to do interval training tomorrow. I mean, how much do you bring in now that you've done the research that you did on this book?
Yeah. Well, any coach will tell you, you know, if they kind of step back and philosophize about what they do, you know, it's largely cognitive behavioral therapy when it's done well, because the mind is the athlete, you know, because you're not just an exercise machine, you're a human being. So, you know, at any point in the journey, whether, you know, you're just getting off the couch and training for your first 5K, or if you're someone who, you know, takes home trophies from races, you are up against some kind of limits. You know, there are obstacles to your further progress. And then it's just all about problem solving. It, you know, it's You know, things need to be talked through. So in that coach athlete relationship, everything is on the table. You know, 'cause you know, you don't always know what the answer is, or it doesn't always come from a workout. It comes from, sort of collecting experience, and sifting through it and just being, you know, very pragmatic, gaining clarity about, you know, what you want, what matters and what doesn't matter to you, you know. Even stuff like that, just like, you know, people can just, you know, get into a sport for one reason and then veer away from it without even really realizing it, that that's happened. And if you become sort of mindful about this stuff and, you know, talk about it, think through it, you know, you are much more likely to stay on course and make steady progress in, you know, toward whatever your true destination really is as an athlete.
Yeah, I found it all, and this relates, I believe, to this, but in your book, you discuss the power of intention, the difference between things like, I think it was an actual marathon, they tested this or something. What was the people that had the intention of, you know, goal, they had a specific goal in mind, they had self-esteem in mind, they had something that versus the people who were running to lose weight. Can you speak to that a little bit, what the difference, how that played out?
Yeah, it was a study involving first-time marathoners, and so these were people, you know, who shared the same goal of running a marathon. But of course, you can run a marathon for a lot of different reasons. So they looked at, you know, specific motivations to run a marathon. Now, what's interesting is that all these people were involved in the same training program. They're all beginners, and they're all doing the same training. So then they correlated specific motivations to do a marathon with dropout rate. So, you know, it was actually kind of sad. There was a pretty high washout rate. So a lot of these people just never did the marathon. But, you know, sure enough, people who had certain types of goals were much more likely to actually see through the process. So it wasn't, you know, the training, because they were all doing the same training. So people, whose goals were more, outward facing, they were running a marathon for peer acceptance. They were running a marathon to lose weight. Those people were much more likely to drop out. And people whose goals were inward facing, it was about, you know, just, you know, personal achievement or, you know, performance or whatever. Those people were much more likely to see through the process.
That's really interesting to me. Do you think that it's a this is kind of total, it could be really a reach, but do you think that it's, to succeed in the modern world, the way that the world is, where a lot of the even physical struggle, well, there's struggles in the modern world. What I'm getting at is to intentionally enter a race or a physical challenge, because that doesn't exist in the way for most of us anyway, at least in America or United States or something, that it doesn't exist day to day, like we can be stagnant. We don't have to do these things. Do you have a comment about that, just in terms of, well, now we live in this world where we don't have to do much. And so intentionally putting ourselves into these kinds of challenges with real goals and with saying, I'm going to take this on because I want to achieve it and know what the struggle is like to do that, how that plays out.
Yeah, I think that bit of sociology is a big part of the reason that, you know, things like marathons and triathlons are so darn popular, is that, you know, I guess in the strictest sense, we are all hedonists, but hedonism, you know, the pursuit of pleasure or happiness, it's highly nuanced. And part of being, you know, again, you know, part of being happy or just, you know, feeling good more often than you feel bad is knowing that you're strong. And so you can have a life where you're completely coddled and pampered and you're comfortable. So in sort of the unsophisticated hedonistic view, there's nothing missing there, right? You know, you've got your microwave to heat up your dinner for you. You've got, you know, cruise control in your car. You're just, you know, totally comfortable and pampered. And yet so many of us, because it's just more complex than that, so many of us who have that totally comfortable life are just dissatisfied. There's something missing, something that used to be there, you know, in past generations. And it's that, you know, those kinds of, you know, physical tests, you know, the overcoming of which, you know, builds strength and awareness of it. And it's just a key piece of the happiness puzzle.
Well, it's like, you know, achievement based happiness, you know, and it's, I think it's frustrating for people, at least in my experience. I think on some level, we as humans understand that the problem is that the marketplace sells us otherwise. You know, the marketplace says you can lose weight with no struggle at all by this pill or by this diet plan. Of course, when you dive into it and have to remember to take the pill, and then you dive into the diet and you realize that what a massive change that is, that there is that idea that okay, well, then there is struggle, but it seems like there shouldn't be. I don't know where that comes from, where it seems like, well, it should be easier than this. Well, why is that? You know, at what point did struggle sort of become a selling point to just remove that completely? I mean, obviously that plays into our hedonism. We want what we want without having to work too hard for it.
Yeah, I mean, we're in a lot of ways in the modern world, we're just victims of our own success. You know, it's like, you know, on the diet theme, you know, a lot of us are overweight today, and a big part of the reason we're overweight is that we've had such tremendous success in feeding ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of having access to a lot of food. Yeah.
And then, you know, getting back to the example of, you know, that something missing, that, you know, strength and awareness thereof, that's a consequence of the success we've had in making life easier. I mean, that's, you know, life is, it's, you know, the, you know, sort of the natural state of things is for life to be a struggle. So you have to be oriented towards making it easier, right? You know, if like that's sort of how we came up is, you know, so that's fine. That's fine and natural. But if you just have tremendous success in overcoming the struggle, then you can have too much of a good thing.
Yeah, it's almost like we actually have the ability to remove day-to-day struggle, but that doesn't mean it makes life easy for us. And it's almost like an inverse proportion that the more day-to-day we live struggle-free via, you know, Tylenol and junk food and stagnancy and watching TV, that removes the day-to-day struggle, but doesn't make for necessarily a happy life.
Yeah. If you look at, you know, so much commercial advertising, especially for technology related things, you know, you'll see taglines like, you know, making life better, you know, this product makes life better. And if you just look at it completely out of context, you're like, yeah, you know, that product does make my life a little better. But then, you know, you get, you know, 100 different products that make your life better. And then you look back and you're like, my life isn't any better.
Yeah. And I spent
no real additive effect.
Yeah. There. And I spent a bunch of money making someone else's life better. Anyway, so another question I had, well, let's get back to the book for a minute. What was your natural, you know, evolution into even researching this? What did you come across that made you want to? I love that you did this in this book. I'll be honest. I was a little skeptical in the beginning because I really wanted when you and I initially talked about it in the first interview and you said, well, it's more like I'm laying out, you know, different examples of athletes, and I was like, all right, but I really want the science. I found your book very supported scientifically and really appreciated that, and I loved the way that you weaved that within the stories of the athletes. I did look up that video of the marathon runner, Sammy, what I can't remember his name offhand, but I mean,
Juan Giroux, yeah.
Yeah, unbelievable. And he ended up dying. He fell off a balcony.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
just incredible. But to be able to dig deep, but what was your initial foray into this whole field?
Well, it's really sort of two separate things. One, you know, I've always been interested in the, you know, the mind-body connection as it relates to endurance sports, the role of the brain in endurance performance. So I've written a lot about that in the past, and I just, you know, I follow the research. You know, I've developed relationships with some of the scientists who are doing pioneering work in this realm. So, you know, I wanted to do a book about specifically this new psychobiological model of endurance performance that was developed by Sam Wellemar-Cora, who wrote the foreword to the book. So there's that, but you know, that's some pretty heady science. So, you know, I think it's practical and relevant. You know, it's science that you can use. It's science that answers the question, you know, what's in it for me, but still, you know, heady stuff. Separately from that, you know, in addition to being an endurance athlete and coach, I'm a fan of these sports. You know, for a lot of people, watching a marathon is like watching grass grow, but You know, I will routinely be moved to tears watching these types of events. Not every stage of the Tour de France, mind you, but, you know, when it really gets exciting.
Right.
You know, when you see the humanity of it, the pathos of it, it's moving stuff. And I've sort of collected these stories over the years, and, you know, I've always, you know, it's been part of my mission to help other endurance athletes and even just people generally see what I see in this type of competition. So I didn't necessarily, it could have been two books, but I thought, you know what, why not bring these two things together, sort of the narrative storytelling part and the science that has practical implications, because I thought the stories really make the science, you know, a lot easier to understand and apply than if it's just, you know, hanging out there on its own.
And what do you see the evolution of endurance sports to be? We are getting faster. People, you know, the guy who just won, this blew my mind, but the guy who just won Western States was 20. Like, he's the youngest winner of the Western States 100. For ultramarathoning, younger doesn't necessarily mean faster in that sport. And then there was also a guy who was 43 who finished top 10. I mean, it was just shocking. But at the same time, it seems like the speed, at least in the ultra world, and maybe marathoning, but you tell me, but is going up. I'm assuming a combination of everything, training ability, equipment maybe, but what part do you see the mental practices, the psychobiology that you were talking about? What part does that, as you see it, play into that?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting about that model is that it sort of removes any separation, you know, between the psychological side of the sport and the rest, because everything is mediated through perception of effort. And just to give you an example, you know, take training, which is, you know, the real nuts and bolts of getting better as an endurance athlete. You know, if you start from zero and do 12 weeks of training appropriately done, after those 12 weeks, you know, maybe at the beginning, a 10-minute mile felt really hard. At the end, a 10-minute mile feels easier. And actually, that is why you're able to perform better. If you gained physical capacity, but it didn't make the same effort feel easier, you actually wouldn't be able to access that increased capacity. So everything, absolutely everything, is mediated through perception of effort. If it doesn't affect perception of effort, you don't improve. So nutrition does that, and you know, training does that. Shoes do it. You know, if you have the shoe that is most economical for you, your perception of effort at any given pace will be reduced, and that is why you'll be able to run faster in that shoe. So it just, everything suddenly goes into the same, you know, soup. Now, having said all that, there are obviously some interventions that are strictly psychological in nature. Things like, you know, training in acceptance and commitment therapy. That's an example I give in the book. So that's the example of, rather than resisting the suffering that is intrinsic, you know, to the sport and your pursuit of goals in it, you know, just consciously embracing it. Or, you know, positive self-talk. That's another example where, you know, studies have been done to show that, like, if you train yourself to be the little engine that could, I think I can, that enhances performance. So we're probably at the beginning of a pretty big wave of getting a lot more rigorous in terms of figuring out, you know, what works and what doesn't work and how, in terms of interventions that are, you know, strictly kind of psychological in nature.
Do you see, are there real practices or real tools that somebody can do to, let's say you don't change your shoes, you wear the same shoes, but can you make efforts? I think you just spoke to this a little bit, but please clarify if you can. Efforts that you can change the perception of effort around the same stuff so that the external things don't change, but your perception of the effort of those things change? Or is it simply a mechanism of doing it long enough to change your perception? It's a give and take between the body and the mind. In other words, you get a little bit more in shape, like you said, so that the 10-minute workout isn't quite as struggle.
Right.
Or are there practices where even in the beginning you can, you know, like Sage Canada, you can learn to separate yourself from the pain?
Yeah. Yeah. So much of it is experience based, and, you know, that's just what it is. You know, my book has been very well received, thankfully, but some of the criticism has been from people who sort of wish that it held your hand more and, you know, provided more of a, you know, a 5-step program to, you know, becoming a mental giant. But it's really hard to do because, you know, each of us is kind of, I try to present a framework that allows you, you know, to, you know, pursue the journey more efficiently, you know, than you might otherwise. But it's still, you know, it's your journey. And so just as an example, you know, really, when, you know, when you go out and do any kind of race, your performance is largely determined by your perception every step of the way about your limits. Just like, you know, you feel a certain way and you have X, you know, distance left to go, and you're just sort of, you know, just kind of semi-consciously asking yourself constantly, like, can I go faster or can I not? And experiences really teaches you to move that line a little bit. There's always, like, you know, there's a fundamental conservatism to those calculations, but you just, and, you know, the research shows it, like, you learn to get more aggressive and to, you know, just inch closer and closer to that edge as you gain experience. And there's no substitute for that at all. You just have to go through the experience. You know, so there are other things that you can use more as tools, that sort of will accelerate the progress. You know, the example of positive self-talk is another one of those. At any level of experience, you know, if you're not good at that, you know, you can just, you know, proactively add that tool to your toolbox.
I mean, we love, you know, in the marketplace, we love lists. I always make fun of them on the, you know, top 10 ways to, you know, this kind of thing. And it sounds, you know, so I try to avoid that at all costs. But what I'm hearing from you is maybe the biggest helpful tool is, like you said, accept that there is struggle about it and that it's going to take time to get used to that and to change your perception of effort around that. And there's no other way to hack that other than just dive in a way that doesn't cause you an inordinate amount of stress. I mean, if you want to be a runner, you don't go out the door and run 20 miles and injure yourself. You take the time it takes to build in both the physical growth, but also the mental growth around that as well.
Yeah. I would agree with that. You know, another way to sort of approach this is to, you know, just think about, you know, your individual, you know, limiters and obstacles as an athlete. You know, if I could sit down with just about any athlete and say, you know, what's holding you back? And they will not miss a beat in being able to tell me. It's like, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, sometimes it's, you know, self-esteem, you know, which is something I address in the book. So say that it's that. That's not the case for every athlete. But if it is, that's another approach you can take to, you know, just, you know, making you know, forward steps in your journey toward mental fitness is to say, okay, I struggle with this. And then, okay, using this, you know, psychobiological framework and the, you know, the tools that it suggests, like, you know, how do I address that now, whether instead of just kind of, you know, hoping it gets better as I gain experience as an athlete.
I was running, I took a run this morning and did like a tempo run with your book in mind, because I thought, well, I'm going to push it a little bit, just to experience what that feels, you know, that whole experience in the context of your book. And so the last mile it's faster than I usually run. And there's real physical, you know, there's a real, for me, I feel it like in my gut, like I get this kind of, it's hard to explain, but that's just this feeling I get in my, for some reason, in my midsection. My legs aren't really that fatigued, but I just feel it. And I was trying to work through that and understand, you know, I only have half a mile left and I'm trying to talk myself through that. It's a really interesting, it's like the body's, I feel like my body's telling me to slow down. Like it's saying, hey, but what you're saying is over time, it really isn't a direct messaging of the body that at that point, I'm not even close to shutting down. If it's only a 3 mile run, that it is where I happen to be in my own experience with, in relationship to that physical sensation. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of cool. I mean, this is why, you know, I intend to keep doing these, sports, you know, as long as I can, because they're endlessly fascinating. So you take an experience like the one you had, you know, your 3 mile tempo run, and you tune in to what you're feeling, and, you know, you start to realize, like, wow, there's really a lot going on here. Like you can explore it, and you can take different perspectives on what's happening. You can focus your attention on something that was sort of, you know, under the surface, you know, underneath maybe, you know, whatever's the most prepotent sensation, like that feeling in your gut. You can like a very basic shift in perspective that, you know, that every athlete has to make at some point is shifting from a perspective where you feel like it's being done to you to you're doing it. Because that sense of agency, it's like, you know, my suffering is happening to me, versus like, this is my effort. I'm making this effort happen. So it's, you know, a big part of the journey is just to sort of become a connoisseur of those experiences and sensations that you're having, because that's what allows you to realize, you know what, I actually can push a little harder. And, you know, I can be more comfortable being uncomfortable.
And the studies you cite in your book about, you know, when people know they have, you know, only this many minutes left, but then you add add the run on to it afterwards, and how that affects their performance, just how much do I have left and that kind of stuff. It's hard for me to get around in my own mind when I'm like today running that last half mile that, you know, I don't want to, I could probably go faster, but there's that thing of like, well, maybe my body is really telling me like, that's not a good idea physically. Like, how do you, it's such a give and take about that, you know, because maybe I could have run a whole minute faster. I probably could have. What you're saying is I'm still long before actual physical shutdown, but how do you negotiate that give and take all the time? Like, I guess I could, maybe I couldn't, I don't want to damage myself. That's a lot going on there.
Right. Yeah. It's important to understand that nobody, and I mean nobody, is capable of pushing all the way to their ultimate physical limits. So you can miscalculate and, you know, have a terrible meltdown in a race or workout, and it's not because you pushed to your limit. So it's just, you know, because I'll give you a specific example. I ran a half marathon last September, and my training had gone well. I was in really good shape, and I'm an extremely experienced athlete, so I've run my share of half marathons. But I just went out there and miscalculated. I bit off a little more than I could chew. You know, my early miles were probably, you know, when you're really riding the line like that, maybe I was only 5 seconds per mile too fast. But when I got to 10 miles, I knew that I was going to just, well, it was just happening. You know, I was just slowing down inexorably. And I can assure you that that wasn't because I was having some sort of catastrophic physiological failure that was going on. It was simply that, you know, my perception of effort, because I'd been too aggressive, had, you know, just gotten to an intolerable level. So, you know, you can overdo it. You're not going to exercise yourself to death, but you can have a perception-based catastrophe that, you know, causes the race or the workout to be a failure. So, you know, in some moments when you're wondering whether you could go faster or not, or you're pushing too hard or not, sometimes the answer is yes, you are pushing too hard, or no, you can't go any faster. So, you know, it's you're calculating. It's cognitive and perceptual what's going on there.
What, and I don't mean to get just off the deep end of just nutty, but at the moment that you were slowing down in that half marathon, and were you thinking, this isn't about physical, this is, I mean, so then there's like the thing, there's like the thing behind the perception of effort, which is, I know this is just my perception of effort, you know, like, where does that, what part does that play where you're running, you know this now, you've written a book on it, you're an expert in it, you understand it, and you're going, this is just my perception. What is stopping you from then pushing ahead saying, you know what, this is just my perception, this is nothing to do with physical, I'm just going to turn it on? Or what is the limitation or constraint in that moment for you?
Yeah, it's simply that you can't, you know, you could be doing a half marathon with a pebble in your shoe, and the pain caused by that pebble, even though it's not hurting you, it's not really damaging you, it's not threatening your life or health, but the pain from that pebble could become so extreme that you have to stop. That's entirely perceptual. You know, you in principle, you could just say, well, it's not really hurting me, and therefore I'll push through it. It doesn't make any difference. And that's kind of one of the, you know, the subtle concepts that people have a hard time understanding, that a psychological limit can be like a brick wall, just like a physical limit. You just, you have limits. You can only tolerate so much pain. You can only tolerate so much suffering. You can't just jump off a building and fly because you say you can. It's the same thing with perception of effort. Like, you know, it doesn't matter if, you know, cerebrally, you know, you're not at your physical limit. You're at a limit that you can't move.
And that's what was happening to you, is just your body was slowing down. Basically what I'm hearing is pretty much all because of your mind.
Yeah. I mean, in that particular workout, it was mostly, you know, sometimes you get so far inside it that, you know, you just become a big baby. And that's what happened to me. Then I was disappointed. You know, because I had really wanted to have a good race. I had, you know, I'm very goal oriented. And so, you know, when a goal that goes out the window, you know, I dropped out of that race. But there have been other races where, I just plowed ahead. And so I knew the meltdown was happening, but I just kept going and let the whole thing play out. So, you know, I'm going from running, you know, a 6 minute mile to a 7 minute mile to an 8 minute mile, and eventually get to the point where I felt like I have absolutely no choice at all but to walk. You know, I have done, and you know, I was, you know, absolutely refusing the process that was unfolding. I was refusing to slow down, and I was slowing down anyway. In the particular race I'm thinking about, I actually ended up walking for a while and then running the last part. Well, it's like, wait a minute. if I was resisting the meltdown, you know, with everything I had, and was reduced to walking, and it wasn't a choice, like, how was I able? It's not like I had a meal, or, you know, I rested for a while. You know, it's like, how was I able to then, you know, run later? You know, it's because I wasn't at my absolute physical limit, and yet it didn't matter. You know, so there you go.
Well, I had the pretty similar experience when I did my 50 miler last year. I think it was about mile 40. I had started the day and this speaks to what I find interesting about this is that, you know, an athlete can have excellent training, everything's lining up, but then for whatever happens race day, it's just not the day. You know, it's not the day. And I think their physical ability didn't change starkly the morning of the race. It's just there can be certain they didn't sleep well, or they, you know, found out some bad news or whatever, and it changes their, again, on that even given day. So I would say it's not even a always an upward forward motion in terms of your perception of effort. That can literally change on a given day if you have a bad day. That's correct, right?
Yeah. It's, you know, sort of casually referred to as the good day, bad day phenomenon. And there's some research on it. I actually, I reference a study about it in the book where what they did is they took a bunch of cyclists and they had them do a simulated time trial on stationary bikes on two separate occasions. So it was exactly the same test and there was no intervention. They didn't like give them a pill between the two tests or whatever. They just, you know, because what will happen is if you take any athlete and have them do exactly the same time trial, you know, a week apart or 10 days apart or whatever, their performance will never be exactly the same, right? Mm-hmm. On one level, you would think, well, it should be because they're the same person and they've been doing the same training, but it just never is. One of them's always going to be a little faster than the other. And what these scientists wanted to do is figure out why. So they measured absolutely everything they could measure to try and figure out, you know, why. You know, some people were faster in the first time trial, some were faster in the second, but they're always faster in one or the other. And they found that none of the physiological measurements they took could explain why, you know, they had a better day one time and a worse day the other time. The only thing that was really different and was, you know, statistically significantly correlated with performance was positive affect. So basically, when they were in a better mood,
right,
or when they just felt better about the time trial, they had a better time trial.
That's I mean, so back to that, exactly. So back to my 50 was at mile 40. I did a video on it on my YouTube channel that people can see, because you can see in my face that I'm freaking over it. And I had traveled. I was jet lagged. And all these things, at least my perception of the jet lag and lack of sleep, set the day just in a really bad way. And yet at the end of the race, the last couple miles, I ran no problem. And so, you know, it's like I didn't, like you said, like I didn't have an injection of caffeine or some sort of anything or gels or anything that all of a sudden made me physically better able to perform the last 2 miles of a 50-mile race. It was 100% me knowing that the horrible day that I just had was about to be over, and that my wife and daughter were waiting for me at the finish line. And how much that can affect our physical ability to perform.
Yep. We don't know entirely why that's the case, but it clearly is the case that there's just a built-in conservatism to these calculations we make. You know, you're just always asking yourself, what am I capable of, you know, in the last, you know, 30 miles to the finish line, 20 miles, 15 miles, 10 miles. And no matter, you know, how tough you are, how experienced, how bad you want it, you leave a buffer there. You just do.
Yeah. You leave a buffer. And then with regard to, you know, to sort of wrap this up in a way to apply it to life outside of athleticism or at least professional athleticism, being clear about your intentions with regard to, let's say you're going on a diet, but like you said, and I've said too, you know, really what you're looking for isn't scale weight. You're looking to live happy. You want to be happier and maybe healthier that leads you to be happier. And to be very clear about your intentions that you want to be a strong, I love what you're saying, like happiness without strength doesn't exist. Like it's part and parcel to the picture of being happy in the world is a personal strength that comes only basically from the experience of achievement and doing things that increase your ability to deal with struggle, how effectively you can do that. I want to finish up by a question that came up in your book, which is the question of pacing. This speaks, you know, directly to my small steps approach of how to coach people to bring in change via size of steps that is minimally stressful to allow the body to adapt along the way, everything else. But with regard to your pacing thing, like you said, there's no way to know at the end of a race, could I have gone faster? So it's such a variable there. How can you speak on the pacing issue with people, with runners, but try to, if you can, relate it to just taking on any kind of change. How do you pace yourself? How do you know? And is it even a relevant question to say, could I have gone faster? Or do you say, that's what I did here. Okay, now moving on.
Yeah. So yeah, speaking, you know, to the concrete issue of, you know, pacing in endurance sports, it's much more helpful to, as I say in the book, there's no such thing as going as fast as you can. You can only go faster than you ever have before. So, you know, instead of, you know, starting a race thinking I'm going to go as fast as I can, you think, okay, what's the best I've done before for this event? I want to improve on that. You know, because then you've got an anchor, you've got a benchmark. And then in that way, you can sort of make, you know, systematic improvements. And only in retrospect can you look back and say, okay, apparently, you know, that was the fastest I could ever do. You know, me, I'm 45 now, so I'm past the age where I'm, you know, I'm setting PRs. But again, it was only in retrospect for me when I, you know, after my last, you know, personal best time was behind me, I could say, okay, that was my best day. I didn't know it at the time. Mm-hmm. All I knew at the time was that it was my best day yet. And I think that sort of approach really is helpful outside of endurance sports as well. Just, you know, don't try to be perfect or flawless or don't try to define the undefinable, you know, the best I can possibly be. Just improve, you know, set benchmarks and try to, you know, even if you can quantify them, so much the better, but just try to take, you know, step by step, get better and better.
To wrap this up, what was your favorite, if you had to pick a favorite, which is the athlete that best embodies what you were writing about in the book?
That is like trying to pick a favorite child.
Is it? There's just too many.
Yeah, it's whatever one I reread most recently or, you know, but, you know, one that people might enjoy that's just sort of the outlier in the group is Willie Stewart. You know, he's sort of the one guy in there who was not a professional athlete, but he's an athlete who lost an arm in a construction accident before he was even ever a triathlete, and then became a triathlete later and became a very good one, never, you know, a professional. But, you know, his story is kind of unique and really cool.
Okay. And tell me what are you working on now?
So my next book is one, it's called The Endurance Diet. So going back to the diet thing, it's a diet, it's a book in which I, I looked for universal best practices among the most successful endurance athletes in all disciplines in all over the world. So the research was awesome. I went to Canada and Spain and Brazil and Kenya, just sitting down eating with the world's best cyclists, cross country skiers, you know, you name it. And also did a lot of other research, you know, just remotely, looking for, it's like, you know, what are, underneath the surface, what are the things that everyone's doing? And, you know, can they be, you know, sort of packaged into a formula that everyday athletes can also benefit from?
Was there some through lines there that were surprising? Like, oh, everybody's doing this in no matter where they live.
Not really, because I already had some background before I went into the process. You know, I didn't just come into it cold. I already had a sense. I mean, part of the reason I took on the project was that, I guess the surprise actually was, you know, was that how much consistency that there really was. Because, you know, on the surface, it looks like there's no consistency, right? You know, like, you know, Kenyans eat ugali 3 meals a day. Mm-hmm. You know, well, Canadians don't.
Yeah, right, right.
But you know, ugali is just starch. It's just, you know, whole grain cornmeal.
Right.
And what I found absolutely everywhere was that people were eating a lot of high quality, you know, high carb, you know, foods. Right. So, you know, the universals were there, but they're underneath a lot of kind of superficial diversity.
Very interesting. And when is that book, when's that the expected pub date on that?
Christmas.
Okay. So you're pumping out some serious books here, sir.
Yeah, you know, not for its own sake, but just because I have a lot of ideas and I just love it. And I think, you know, every book has a reason, you know?
Yeah. No, it's excellent. And I do want to tell my listeners that I wanted to get to this, but I think it's probably just not in the good context of this conversation. But there's a great article. I was doing a little more research on you before this interview and I found an article you wrote, I believe in Runner's World, on lactic acid, which I was like, finally, because there's so much misconception or at least old news about that hasn't been improved upon in the mainstream. You know, it's sort of like the beans and rice myth. You know, it's like everyone just goes, oh yeah, lactic acid buildup. But I love the article you wrote. When I cannot remember. Was that 2012?
You know, yeah, I wrote that for Competitor, I think. And it would have been earlier than that, but they actually reuse everything I wrote when I was a staff editor with them. So you'll see pub dates that are misleading.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the link that I found, it wasn't in Runner's World, it was a Competitor magazine?
It was for one of the Competitor Group's assets. It could have been Triathlete magazine or
okay. And but the science on that, as far as you know, hasn't changed. I mean, the things that you wrote about in that are pretty holding true.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the myths that it busts, you know, haven't been sort of unbusted.
Okay, cool. Okay, then I will. If you were just to tell me like, oh yeah, no, I got completely debunked and I got sued on that, I'd be like, okay, well, I'm not gonna link to that article anyway. But okay, so I will link to that to Mike, because anybody who's athletes and who thinks they know what they know about lactic acid, it was a pretty pretty eye-opening article. But okay, other than the book, anything else that you're up to?
Yeah, I probably shouldn't open that can of worms, because there's so much, you know. It's like, you know, running doesn't pay all my bills, so I do other interesting stuff that might have to wait for another time.
Gotcha. Well, how can people find out about you? Give them your contact info, at least on social media and stuff like that.
Yeah, so the place to start is mattfitzgerald.org. And yeah, I'm on Twitter at mattfitwriter.
Mattfitwriter.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Well, I really appreciate your time coming back here, Matt. And with the amount of books you're putting out, I'm obviously have interest in the next book too. So I'd love to have you back on. Maybe you can be the only person to ever have been on my podcast 3 times. That would be a really good goal for you.
Sweet. Yeah. That is a goal.
Yeah, it's a goal that not only is specific, but I think it would also add to your self-esteem.
Very much so.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks for having me.
Not much.
And best of luck to you and all of your efforts. I love what you do, and you're an excellent, excellent writer. So keep up the good work. Okay.
Thanks, Sid.
All right. Thanks, Matt.
All right, you guys. What'd you think? Good stuff. He's a great guy, great writer. I highly recommend his work. All of it. Just do it. He's cool. All right. I'm wrapping it up for this week. Listen, I didn't mention in the intro because I'm just not good at this stuff. Please go to my YouTube channel. I'm posting twice a week. It's looking like, don't hold me to this yet, but it's kind of looking like Mondays and Thursdays. That's just what's happening. Last few weeks, I'm posting a video on Monday and a video on Thursday. Subscribe to my channel. I got some emails, nice emails from listeners who say they're telling people about the podcast and about the video, and that's just huge, and I really appreciate that. And by the way, if you do feel like emailing me, podcast@sidgarzahillman.com. That's podcast@sidgarzahillman.com. I will be back next week with a more regularly type scheduled podcast. So join me next week. Come on back and enjoy. And I hope you liked this episode. All right. You guys are awesome. Keep the good work a-coming. And that's the good work of a small stepper, by the way. If you guys want to know, you know what constitutes good work for a small stepper? Treating yourself well, taking care of yourself, actually taking care of yourself. In whatever you do, that's your backdrop. Do a diet, do a training plan, fine. Take care of yourself. Treat yourself well through that process, because change ain't easy. We know it, and now we know how to handle that. We know how to get through it the best way possible and the fastest way possible. It is the fastest way possible. It sounds slow. It ain't slow. All right? Come back next week and you'll hear why. In the meantime, you guys, be well.
If I lived on Phillips Avenue, things would be presented so simply and if I lived on Phillips Avenue, I wouldn't have to beg for an unraveling. If I lived on Phillips Avenue, I'd walk around with a wall around me. I'd be blind and deaf and dumb at most things. I'd see more clearly than I've ever seen. And if I were you, maybe this would be untrue. And maybe problems lie so deep that they cannot be. Phillips Avenue, I wouldn't need these old distractions. And if I lived on Phillips Avenue, I wouldn't re-question these wrong decisions. And if I lived on Phillips Avenue, I'd be so satisfied you wouldn't even know me. Think I never needed. And if I were you, maybe this would be untrue. And maybe problems lie so deep that they cannot be and if I were you maybe this would be untrue and maybe problems lie so deep. lived on Phillips Avenue.